this is Allison Sheridan of the NosillaCast podcast, hosted over at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, May 15th, 2011, and this is show number 312. Well, this week, I am finally going to answer one of George from Tulsa's ever-present dumb questions. I've got, Shia is going to tell us about the Passport SIM card to save you money on international roaming charges while traveling abroad. I've got a review of the Hasbro My 3D Viewer, and I have an in-depth, hands-on review of the new BlackBerry Playbook. In Chit Chat Across the Pond, we're going to be joined by Kirshen Shay, I think it's pronounced, and Alistair Jenks to talk about flight technology advancements. Let's go ahead and get started.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions. Dumb questions.
How do I?
What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Hi, Allison. It's George from Tulsa here. You know how many times I've sent you a dumb question? I can't count. You've never answered one. In fact, you're almost making me think I'm too smart for a dumb question. But here goes. I just downloaded a brand new album from Amazon MP3. It's 305.6 megabytes. That's on my hard drive. Now, as you know, Amazon and Google, and probably soon Apple, are offering cloud lockers to let you stream your music back to yourself from the cloud. So here's the dumb question. If I stream that music back to me on my computer, am I using 305.6 megabytes of my recently capped internet? And wouldn't that be terrible to use 3G or 4G capped signal to a cell device to listen to such music? Me, I'm buying more flash memory cards for my phone. What do you think?
Well, George, you wore me down. I think I will answer this one. To be perfectly honest, I've never known the answer to any of your quote-unquote dumb questions before, but this time I do know the answer. The answer to your question is yes. All right, I wanted to just leave it there for the comedy, but Steve wouldn't let me. He said I've got to explain. Well, you're spot on that streaming music, no matter the source, would use your bandwidth. In your example, you only listen to it once a month. If you just bought it, though, isn't it likely you're going to listen to it more than once? That means 611.2 megabytes of bandwidth if you listen to it twice. If you like Pandora for music streaming, that uses up bandwidth, too. Oh, and don't forget, if you have upload caps as well, moving that 305.6 megabytes of music up to the Cloud Locker, you're going to have to worry about that as well. Now, I don't think it's coincidental at all that just as these great new cloud-based services for music and video streaming are taking off, think live NosillaCast, the service providers are now putting caps on us. I don't know of any other industry that penalizes its users for using what they're paying for. I nearly got in a fist fight with a corporate Verizon rep once. He was trying to patiently explain to me that this was only about data hogs who abused the network. I tried to explain to him that usage of streaming video, like my high-def podcast, were pushing these envelopes. He talked to me like I was an addle-pated child as he patiently explained that I didn't understand the problem. I had to go take a shower after talking to those guys. So, as I said earlier, the answer is yes. Let's hear next from Shai Yamini.
Hi, Allison and all the Nosilla castaways. Shai here calling from Cobb in Ireland. Now, an issue that I've been having while on my travels around the world is how to stay in contact with family, friends, colleagues, and clients. I've tried countless methods, including wasting time looking for internet cafes, roaming with my phone provider, even struggling with the slow and intermittent internet and satellite phones on the ship I'm working on. None of these methods are very convenient and usually end up costing me a small fortune. So, after copious amounts of searching, I found a convenient and rather cost-effective solution. Unfortunately, this solution requires a phone that is unlocked. So I am passing on my apologies to all the iPhone users in the USA, unless, of course, you have jailbroken your iPhone and unlocked it to use other carriers. I have found an international SIM card that allows me to travel to most parts of the developed world and receive phone calls and texts, for the most part, free. That's right, free. These countries include, now, you wait for it, Algeria, Armenia, Australia, Austria, Bahrain, Belgium, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Brazil, British Virgin Islands, Cayman Islands, Chile, Costa Rica, Croatia, Cyprus, Czech Republic, Denmark, El Salvador, Estonia, Fiji, Finland, France, Georgia, Germany, Ghana, Gibraltar, Greece, Hungary, Ireland, Israel, Italy, Jamaica, Japan, Kenya, Latvia, Lesotho, Lithuania, Luxembourg, Malawi, Montserrat, Namibia, Netherlands, New Zealand, Niger, Nigeria, Norway, Oman, Poland, Portugal, Romania, San Marino, Seychelles, Slovakia, Slovenia, South Africa, South Korea, Spain, Sweden, Switzerland, Tajikistan, Tanzania, Trinidad and Tobago, Turkey, Uganda, United Kingdom, United States, Vietnam, and Zambia. All right, well, I apologize if I mispronounced any of those countries. Now, this SIM card works in many more countries, but there is a charge to receive text and calls in them at different rates, depending on where they are. This service is called the Passport SIM Card by Telestial Wireless Solution for Travelers. I'll make sure I pass on the link to Alison for the show notes. Now, this service gives you a global phone number, which happens to be a UK plus 44 number, but you can easily apply for a free US number as well. This means that anyone in the UK or US can call or text you at their local rate. There is a small connection fee on my end of about 30 cents, but really, it's nothing compared to the roaming rates that you get charged. Now, calls made from this SIM card vary in price depending on where you're calling from. It can be 25 cents a minute, 65 cents a minute, $1.40 a minute if you're calling from somewhere like Antarctica, or $4.90 a minute if you're calling from somewhere like in Marsat, or, like myself at the moment, on a cruise ship in the middle of the ocean close to nowhere. I've managed to get around a lot of these costs by texting the person I want to talk to for about 70 cents, that's what I've been charged so far, and get them to call me back. Now, for people who like to document the journey, there is also an opt-in travel journal this service provides. I have opted for the automatic journal option, which means it makes a new entry whenever I switch countries without me having to do anything at all. It also shows me where I've been with pins and a trail on a map. Otherwise, you can create entries by using your phone or by logging into the website. You can also add sound, music, photos, and videos into your journal. This journal can also be set to private, friends and family only, or completely public. You can allow comments if you wish, and you can even have it push out to Facebook or Twitter whenever a new entry is added. There's even an email postcard that can automatically be sent to friends and family when a new entry is made. This links them to your journal, where they can leave comments and even send you text messages at no cost at all to them. The Passport SIM card costs $29, but comes with $10 credit already. Shipping will cost varying amounts depending on where it's being sent. Now, although this isn't a perfect solution for everyone, if you are a frequent traveller or going on a big holiday and like the ability to be contacted at little cost to you, then it is most definitely worth trying. My costs have dropped dramatically, which now means I can spend more money on my up-and-coming wedding. As always, it is a pleasure listening to your podcast, Alison, and I can't wait to get back into the live chat room. Until next time, see ya.
Well, thank you, Shai, but I am kind of jealous on account of we can't use that. I did some checking around. I tweeted about it and was able to find a link on AT&T's website where they did confirm what you said, that AT&T iPhones cannot be unlocked. But AT&T does offer that they have very affordable international rates that you can get. Yeah, I believe I saw at one point 200 megabytes of data is $200 or something like that. That was data. I'm not sure about the voice. I would just never turn my phone on. Well, this week is exciting for me because it's the long-anticipated ScreenSteps 2.9 has been released. It's been killing me to not talk about it while it was in beta, not because I was under any kind of, you know, non-disclosure agreement or anything like that, but, you know, it just doesn't seem right to plug something that's still in beta because you never know what's going to happen. I think I've been using that beta for, oh, months now. Anyway, finally it's here, and it has the most exciting new features. I know Bart wanted this one forever. It now has lists. You can make numbered lists to correspond to your lovely sequence numbers, or you can make a bulleted list if you're that kind of, you know, freeform hippie type. ScreenSteps 2.9 has improved PDF support, including flexibility in font choices and support for all languages ScreenStep supports. David Bogdan from Japan, you've heard him on the show before, the teacher over in Japan, he tested it out in Japanese and he confirmed that it works perfectly. If you've already bought ScreenSteps, I highly recommend this upgrade. You're going to be amazed at how often you actually needed bulleted and numbered lists, and just that by itself is worth the free price of the upgrade. If you haven't bought ScreenSteps yet, why? I don't understand that. Anyway, head on over to ScreenSteps.com and at least run the free trial through its paces. You know you want to. When you were a little kid, did you ever have a ViewMaster? You remember those things? It was a little plastic device that had two separate eyepieces and a slot into which you placed like this paper disc with these little tiny plastic film images on it. And then when you put your eyes up to the viewer, you would see a 3D image of the sights of Washington, D.C., or at least that's the pictures I got when I was a little kid. Anyway, I did a little searching around, and it turns out the ViewMaster's been around since 1962, and you can still buy them from Fisher-Price. Now, I know that's not very high-tech, but if you're a geek, you're going to love what my friend John Mallinson found. Hasbro has come out with the My3D Viewer. The My3D is just like the old ViewMaster, but instead of sticking in a paper disc of images, the My3D takes an iPod Touch or iPhone for the imagery. I thought it was really dumb when John described it. I'm like, you know, you're like a grown-up and your kid's a baby, so he's not going to use this, but why are you buying this silly little toy? But then he showed it to me, and I was amazed at how cool this thing is. So you open up the back plate of the My3D, and you place your iOS device into it and close it back up. You then download an application from the iTunes Store. He had the My3D Presents, which is sort of like a showcase that shows you what the My3D can do. First, he showed me a couple of movie trailers, which I found mildly entertaining. I'm just really not that fond of 3D movies myself, but the other people really seemed to like it. But then he turned on a 3D Space Invaders-like video game, and I loved it. You look like a complete and utter dork with this thing because you're holding this mighty 3D viewer up to your face, but you're spinning around because you look up and down and around. I mean, it's full 3D. I mean, you're spinning around. You're looking up. You're looking down. And the whole time, you're shooting at these bad guys with your thumbs on the screen through these little holes in the device. I found it very, very compelling. I was immediately immersed in the games. Now, so far, there aren't a ton of games for the My3D, but there's a free 3D shark game that looks pretty scary. A $5 game called Sector 17. Let's see, the free Bubble Bolt and Tunnel Pilot and the $1 Shatterstorm. You can find the My3D Viewer a lot of different places, but John bought his from Target for only $25. If you follow me on Twitter, you know that I celebrate a holiday every week called Taco Bell Thursday. As healthy as Steve and I are, eating fresh vegetables and wheat bread and all that nonsense, we do have our weekly vice, and we really look forward to it. Everyone on Twitter knows about it, and when Don McAllister came to visit from the UK, it just happened to be a Thursday, so you know we treated him to Taco Bell. But this week, as I was about to tweet from my Mac about Taco Bell Thursday, I realized that for some reason I had never created a text expander snippet for Taco Bell Thursday. What a huge oversight. All I had to do to correct the error was select the words I had most recently typed them. I held down Option T, and up pops a text expander window where I can type in the snippet I want to use instead of typing out all that text every time. In just those 2 to 3 seconds, I've set up a snippet to save me at least 15 characters typed a week. Now, why haven't you bought text expander yet? Get on over to smilesoftware.com and just get it now, would you? For the past week, I've had the opportunity to work with the new BlackBerry Playbook. There's a lot to like about the Playbook and some real drawbacks as well, I'm afraid. Let's start with the form factor. It's just a smidge thicker than the iPad 2, but it weighs about 30% less. It's only a 7-inch diagonal screen, but I didn't find that to be really a bad thing because the screen on this thing is outstanding. The PlayBook screen is 1024 by 600, while the iPad is 1024 by 768. But since the PlayBook is half the size, it means that it's got a pretty much a double the pixel density, so it looks significantly crisper than the iPad. Really makes me want to get the Retina display on the iPad, that's for sure. They include a high-def video on the device that really shows it off. At the beginning, there's a turtle swimming underwater, and, I mean, it's practically 3D. It's so beautiful. The PlayBook is available right now only in Wi-Fi, and I personally would never buy a Wi-Fi tablet because it really limits what you can do with it. Maybe you live somewhere where you've got Wi-Fi all day every day, but I sure don't. The PlayBook was easy to hook up to different networks, but on more than one occasion, it lost the connection while it was asleep, and I had to go through the configuration again, which was, kind of disappointing. Didn't happen often, but more than once. I really like the user interface on the PlayBook. To launch applications, you swipe up from the black bezel below the screen, which is actually touch sensitive. You might not realize it can do that at the beginning, but the first thing that happens when you open this up is it says, hey, you want to watch a little video on how to use that? And that's the one thing they show you, is that you swipe up from the bottom to launch to look at applications, and you swipe down, touching the black up at the top, in order to get to configurations. The PlayBook actually does allow background processing, so you can seamlessly flip back and forth between running applications. You don't ever wait for a web page to redraw because it's already running. You never wait for a video to start up because it's been waiting in the background and starts up instantly when you flip to it. When you swipe up with running applications, you'll see each application on screen in a line, and you can swipe side to side to see what's running and also close the applications from this view. The interface is very, very smooth. It's very clean and easy to remember once you've done it once. A lot of people I showed it to said, oh, that's not intuitive, but then the second time they did it just fine. So I think it's just not what we're used to. The PlayBook is being touted as the tablet that can play Flash, but for me, it's just not that big of a deal. I had to install Click to Flash on Safari and start hunting around for sites that wouldn't display. It took me quite a while to find a site. Only by searching for Flash site did I ever find anything. Loading the interactive Flash sites took an awfully long time on the PlayBook, enough that I gave up on some of them altogether. When I gave up waiting for them, I found I couldn't back out of the sites. I couldn't do anything except quit the web browser. Then when I relaunched it again, I wasn't able to browse anywhere at all. I had to go online to figure out how to reboot to get it to work again. Now, a friend of mine found there's actually a reboot button in the interface, but I didn't find that on my own. Oh, well, it's a good thing I don't really care about Flash. I'm not going to test that again. The browser is very good. It's easy to navigate and move around. It has nice, easy-to-navigate tabs you can get to if you swipe down from above. Really, really works well. Now, I did some timing tests of the browser on the PlayBook versus my first-generation iPad, and the browser on the PlayBook was much slower. Loading 11 thumbnail images in Facebook took 18 seconds on the PlayBook and took only 3 seconds on the iPad 1. Now, I think what they might have been doing was actually loading the real image behind the thumbnail, because when I went to the real images, they just popped up instantly on the PlayBook, where on the iPad they had to load for a second or two. But I'm not sure that's a great choice. That just doesn't sound like they've optimized it properly to me. I played an Old Spice commercial from YouTube. It buffered for 45 seconds in the middle of the video on the PlayBook, but playing the same commercial on the iPad 1, it did not buffer at all, sitting on the same Wi-Fi network. And I had never played the video on either of the devices. Since most other things seem very responsive on the PlayBook, like I said, I think they just have some work to do on optimizing the browser. I doubt that this is a hardware limitation. On more than one occasion, the PlayBook got confused between landscape and portrait, showing the opposite orientation. Not sure exactly what caused it, but it would eventually sort itself out. I'm pretty forgiving on that kind of thing on a first-generation device, though. You know, that'll work itself out. Or they will work it out. The PlayBook comes with Office to Go, which was pretty cool. I sure wish I had that on the iPad. Typing on the PlayBook isn't awful, but it isn't great either. The PlayBook is too small to have a comfortable touch typing experience, but it's too big to hold easily in two hands and thumb type. It doesn't auto-correct, but if you double-tap on a word it recognizes as being misspelled, it shows you some options from which you can choose to replace the word. Works well enough, but really more old-school, like using a word processor on a laptop. The PlayBook's most curious absentee feature is its lack of integrated mail, calendar, and contact programs. The only way you can run those applications natively, not browser-based applications, is to connect your BlackBerry via a tool they call BlackBerry Bridge. It's not exactly tethering, just a way for the BlackBerry to drive the playbook so you can use your productivity applications. This is a really, really goofy idea, in my opinion. It means that RIM is taking this, you know, potential audience down to the rapidly diminishing number of BlackBerry users. You know, they probably had a hard sell in the first place, but now you're saying, okay, it's only a subset of the users that can actually use it. It's even worse, though. AT&T, one of the major BlackBerry carriers, has decided not to support BlackBerry Bridge. I'm not sure exactly why. I haven't talked to AT&T, but the rumors are that AT&T believes that it's a form of tethering, and so they won't let them do it. So now it's not just BlackBerry users that can use it. It's only non-AT&T BlackBerry users. Now, I'm getting a T-Mobile BlackBerry to test the feature anyway, but I won't be able to tell you about it until that device arrives. I realize that it may be a moot point by the time you hear that part, but for closure, I just really want to see what it's like. You never know what the future may bring, so it's good to keep our eyes open. Let's move along. One problem with any new operating system is the dearth of applications, and since the playbook uses the QNX operating system, QNX, which actually is one of its strengths, because, I mean, it is beautiful, it is fluid, it does do background processing, it's very, very useful, it means that there's hardly any apps available. I looked for the Kindle app and Skype, but no go. Heck, there's not even a native Twitter app on this thing. When you first look at your apps that are preloaded, you'll find apps like Twitter, but a whole lot of them are just web apps, not native. My first instinct was to forgive the playbook for not having many apps. I mean, you know, what brand new OS/device would actually have a lot of apps? There might be a more dismaying reason for this, though. It might be that it's just much more difficult to develop for the playbook than it is for iOS or Android. In Jamie Murai's blog, blog.jamiemurai.com, he has a post entitled, You Win, RIM. He outlines exactly what makes it so much more difficult. It's a very interesting read, really gives you the flavor from a developer's point of view. I'm not going to read the whole thing to you, but needless to say, when he got to the part where he had to go get a notary public to sign off on part of the paperwork in order to become a developer, I think that was when he hit the wall and said, I'm done. So like I said, it is a really good read. I recommend you go check it out. And of course, I've got the link in the show notes. If what he says is representative of the issues, and if RIM doesn't change the cost and complexity, the dearth of playbook apps could be here for quite a long time. As of right now, the BlackBerry Playbook isn't accessible to the blind, but I did find a project to manage the accessibility to QNX source code that started about a year ago. I have no idea, and I can't tell whether they've made any progress, but the project does have 202 members. The Playbook also does have a video chat application, but it's only compatible with other playbooks. Yeah, it's great. Anyway, so far I've told you that the video is fantastic on the Playbook, web surfing is pretty good, there's very few apps for the Playbook, including email, contacts, calendar, and that it plays Flash, unlike most tablets out there today. You could almost give the $500 16GB Wi-Fi-only Playbook a C+, except for one thing. I don't think the battery has lasted 2 hours in any of my testing. I couldn't believe it when partway through the first day I realized I had to charge it. I charged it all night long, and when I unplugged it, the device turned on. I pushed the red power button, slipped it into the case, and later that day when I pulled it out, it had turned itself on, and the battery was showing at zero. Not quite sure how it had enough power to show that, but I didn't even get to play with it once that day. Other days, I would show it around to people, I mean, literally 2 hours at the absolute outside, and it didn't last. I've heard it said that if you can't get from L.A. to Boston on a single charge, then it's not a device worth carrying. I think I agree with that. It's very sad when you see a device with so much potential to take such bad turns. Turns that seem really obvious after the fact, but must be terribly easy to do right, or everyone would make a tablet as good as the iPad. Anyway, stay tuned for my BlackBerry Ridge experiment with the T-Mobile BlackBerry, just for fun when it comes in. I remember when I was growing up and working with my dad in the shop, he was the happiest man on earth. He loved building things and fixing things, and there was pretty much nothing he couldn't fix. But he did have his nemesis, and that was working on cars. I remember him telling me once that the only thing he hated more than working on cars was working on automobiles. If you feel this way too, and you live in the LA or Orange County areas, and you drive a Honda or an Acura, give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or send him an email at hdabob@aol.com. He'll come to your house and he'll do all the work and you can relax and do whatever it is you like to do. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, Honda Worldwide. that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Planet, and we really mean it this time. We have two guests on for Chit Chat Across the Pond, and we're going to start with Alistair Jenks, who is at this moment in New Zealand. How are you doing today, Alistair?
I'm fine, thanks, Alison. It's currently just about 10 a.m. in the morning on Sunday here.
So it's 10 a.m. in the morning Sunday for you. It's 3 in the afternoon for me. And our other guest is Kirshen, who is not actually in her normal state. Where is it you are right now, Kirshen?
Right in the United Kingdom right now on vacation. And it is 11 p.m. on May the 14th.
Wow. Oh, that's right. It's May 15th where Alistair is.
So multiple time zones around the world.
I love it. I love it. And Kirshen, I wanted you to tell them exactly how is it you're doing this? You've gone on a big adventure going to England this time, right?
This is true. This is a really big adventure. It's a big birthday for me today. Yay!
Yay! Happy birthday!
Yay. And I'm actually traveling light this time. I have an iPad with the Bluetooth Apple keyboard. And an iPhone, and that's how I'm connected. I'm connected via Wi-Fi through a Wi-Fi router here at where I'm staying.
And what are you using for a mic?
Would, believe it or not, the plain, ordinary earphones and microphone that come with your standard iPhone.
Wow.
Works great.
Sounds fantastic.
Yeah, so the iPhone's doing the audio connection, and I have the iPad all set up to do references and things, so I'm really all ready for this.
This is really, really cool. And to think that we're doing this across the planet and you're only traveling with two handheld devices, we did have to do some editing of or changes to the wiki that we used, because the one I normally use is not accessible to the iPad for editing. So we're experimenting with wiki spaces here, and I'll probably do a little review of what we were looking for and what we found here. So anyway, that's the mechanics behind the show. But what I wanted to talk about was you're a pilot, right?
Yes, I am.
And I'm really intrigued in what's going on today with technology and flying. But I wasn't sure I could ask intelligent questions. So that's why Alistair's here, because while he's not a pilot himself, his father was a pilot, and he's a flight aficionado. So we're hoping to talk about that and then maybe get into some stuff about photography of for planes.
Yep, sounds like a plan.
You up for the challenge, Alistair?
Let's do it.
All right, well, this is cool. I can't believe we're finally getting this done. So where do you want to start us out, Kirshen?
Well, first off, I do work for a company that makes equipment for aircraft, avionics, which are aviation electronics. And what I'm about to share during the course of this presentation, this podcast, is what people can find online if you look up Wikipedia or look up various reference books. So it's publicly available information. So just in case.
Okay.
But yep. Right. So one of the things is when I learned how to fly, it was with a single engine aircraft, two people, two seats. And it had a whole bunch of mechanical instruments. Nothing. The only electronic device on the aircraft was the radio. We didn't even have a GPS. Radios let us talk to the control towers and also tune into radio navigation aids. So it lets us pilots figure out where we are on a paper map. So it's very mechanical. It's very paper, you know. Physical pieces of paper oriented. So the equipment I used included very advanced things like gyroscopes, yes, like spinning tops that keep their position in space. So they let you, the pilot, know if your aircraft is upside down or right side up, which was quite a
in case you didn't notice that on your own.
True. Your ears can deceive you if your ears have those little loops that tell you balance and so on. If you go into a turn, sometimes your ears can deceive you, and you might think that you're straight and level, but your plane's going around in a circle or something. So looking at your compass, looking at this device called the attitude indicator, which was just a gyroscope, the pilot can then deduce whether they were upright and so on, because this was invented back in the 1920s when there were a lot of these airmail pilots that would go into clouds and then get disoriented and then come out of clouds upside down and lots of accidents. So
I actually have a quick little story about the attitude controls or display. Mm-hmm. I had the opportunity to sit in Howard Hughes' chair in the Spruce Goose. Before it was sold to the Rather Corporation, the guy that was the co-pilot on the flight, Dave Grant, was a friend of mine, and he took us down there. And the way the attitude control or display worked on that plane was it was painted on the windshield. Because they knew it was only Howard who was ever going to fly, so it was set exactly for his height.
Yeah.
That's even more crude, right?
Yep, pitch up, pitch down. You know, you weren't going to fly a loop or something, or in the clouds.
Probably not on that plane.
Yes, yes. But that is an awesome aircraft. It's up in Oregon right now.
Yeah,
haven't been there yet.
Mm-hmm. So how have things changed?
Well, now with the advent of electronic devices, everything's all solid state, and we're using gyroscopes, on the count of fact that they have moving parts, tend to wear out and typically wear out at the worst possible moment. For example, if you're in the clouds, so you don't want that to happen. So what we've done is to build solid state devices. For example, the iPhone 4 has this solid-state device called a gyroscope. It's the same gyroscope that would drive the attitude indicator. It knows how you move the device in three axes. You've got the axes called pitch, which is tilts the aircraft, either points a nose up or points a nose down. That's pitch, up or down. And then you've got roll, which is rotating about the center line of the aircraft, so you're rolling either left or right. And then you've got yaw, which moves the nose of the aircraft along a vertical axis. So you could be pointing left or yaw pointing right. So yaw to the left or to the right. So it's motion in three rotational axes. And then you've got position, X, Y, Z, location in space. So the gyroscope helps you determine if your aircraft is straight and level, pitching up, climbing, descending, or turns, and so on. So the fact that you've got that gyroscope in your iPhone, it's a testament to the fact that we've been able to build these solid state devices and deploy them in aviation electronics.
Go ahead, Alistair.
So Kushin, you said it's the same gyroscope. I don't know if it's exactly the same one, but is the one in the iPhone of the same grade as those used in aircraft? I'm thinking that reliability must be a big thing in the sky versus which way I'm pointing my iPhone for a game of Jenga.
There you go. This is true. Reliability with respect to aircraft grade equipment, we have to test. Equipment is being tested to, especially if it's equipment which is critical to flight. If this fails, really, really bad things will happen. So there all the aircraft regulatory agencies require that if you've got equipment which pilots need to maintain the aircraft in flight, that equipment has to be tested according to a standard set of rules and compliances. And that's embodied in a rule that a lot of people in the aviation industry call DO-178B. It involves a lot of code inspection, part inspection, inspection of processes, and so on. And for the most critical flight components or displays and so on, and gyroscopes and such, they have to have a failure of 1 in 10 to the 9. In other words, one failure in 10 to the 10 to the 9. I reckon that if you had a day of failure, that would be a day in 2.something million years. So
I think that's trillion, right? Is 10 to the 9?
3 6
a day, a year. So yeah, it's huge.
It's almost as big as our national debt, right? But we want to talk about that, right?
That's true.
You mentioned the show notes. That gyroscope is done with MEMS, the microelectromechanical systems.
Microelectromechanical systems. And what they do is you're able to detect positions of a little weight in the middle, for example, whether it moves off to one side or the other, and the system's able to measure displacement of these little tiny silicon bits embedded within the chip, and it's able to tell displacement and so on. So it can tell if you're moving one way or another. Of course, more sophisticated ways of similar ways of keeping track of your aircraft's attitude use different technologies. So MEMS is what we use in the iPhone. And if you look at the teardowns in iFixit, you'll actually see them call out the MEMS component within there. So it's not the same grade. It's similar in technology, but not the same grade. Yeah. In fact, I've seen somebody mount an iPad inside a single-engine high-wing replica of a Piper Cub. They call that the iCub or something.
I love the mashups. That's great stuff.
I know. It's too cool. Yeah.
What about in terms of displays in the cockpit?
Well, we've moved from mechanical instruments to things which you will really enjoy, Alison, electromechanical instruments that were tied into sensors on board the aircraft that would show if you were climbing or descending. So no gyroscopes, but you know, electromechanical aids to fully electronic displays. The industry started with cathode ray tubes. Yes, we know those displays. and they don't have any moving parts. So they would put on that particular display the same information that you would see on your basic instruments, your airspeed indicator, your attitude indicator, the altimeter, which tells you how high you are above mean sea level, heading information, and so on. So they started with cathode ray tubes, CRTs, and then when LCDs became, liquid crystal displays became reasonably available, those were used in place of the LCD, or in place of the CRTs. So, and then more and more of the display logic was moved from electromechanical instruments to software. So the software has to be checked and made compliant to this 10⁻⁹ degree of certification. If it
you're
was
saying you don't
be,
want a blue screen of death in the middle of
yeah,
that?
Yeah, the blue
not
screen of death takes
good.
On a whole new meaning.
Not very good. True.
Yeah, I got to ask you, though, do you still find yourself tapping the display if you don't like what it says?
I heard tell of some pilots do that. You know, they would tap, even though it's an LCD, you know, sometimes because of electromechanical, they tend to stick. So you tend to tap that and make sure it starts moving. You know, I've seen some pilots actually tap LCDs just
I think that'd be a habit
so.
That'd be hard to break,
I
right?
Know. I know.
When it comes to the instrument displays, are they still making it look like the old ones, or are they trying new forms of presentation?
Well, the presentation's changed quite a bit since, you know, when I trained in my little single engine plane, all the dials were circular. So you had a round dial for the airspeed, which is like a speedometer, tells you how fast your plane was flying through the air. And then you had a round dial in the middle that would have a white line across with a blue area on top depicting the sky, a brown area depicting the ground. So as long as you had blue above over brown, you were flying right side up. If you had brown over blue, you were flying upside down. So that's how you could tell. That's a gyroscopic attitude indicator. And all the other instruments are all dials. So when these electronic flight information systems came along, they sort of replicated the basic display. So you had a CRT perhaps in the middle of your flight deck, your cockpit, which would show blue over brown, and then tick marks to indicate 5 degrees pitching up, pitching down, and so on. And they might have the old display sitting off to the side for airspeed and because they would just initially it would replace just the one main display, the attitude indicator. Then as time went on, more and more features were integrated into that one single display. So nowadays you don't have those circular dials anymore. You have little tapes, much like how do I describe those things? Real hard to say. They're like, think of having a tape measure on the side of your screen that scrolls up and down, showing you how fast you are. That's how I would describe the airspeed indicator on the left-hand side. But the relative position of that airspeed indicator is in the same sort of location with respect to the attitude indicator. So it would be on the left-hand side of the display, because that's where you normally would see your airspeed. It would be on the left-hand side of the attitude. So on the left-hand side of your electronic display would be this tape, and it would show you how fast you were going through the air. On the right-hand side of this display would be another tape, and that would show you how fast you were, how high you were with respect to sea level, mean sea level, basically. That would be your replacement for the altitude, your altimeter.
Figuring that out? What is that instrumentation?
Well, for the altimeter, it's a little tube that goes out in my little small single-engine plane. It was a little tube that went outside to the side of the plane, and there was a little hole on the side of the plane, and it would sense the ambient air pressure.
Oh.
Yeah. And it would think, okay, the air pressure is this low, we know the surface air pressure is this, and move the needle to, 5,000 feet, for example.
Hmm. Okay.
And nowadays,
I was going to say, is it something different now?
Yeah, we use pressure transducers.
Okay, so
it's a little device that is all electronic. It senses the pressure, converts it to a voltage or a current, and then you have software which looks at the voltage or current and says, this corresponds to a pressure of so much, and therefore you must be 20,000 feet, for example. So more solid state instruments versus mechanical instruments with needles and things. Yeah.
So many years ago, I worked on a project where we had a night vision system on a helicopter. Mm-hmm. Has any of that made it into the commercial world?
Yes. In fact, most of the newer business jets, and slowly it gets into the other parts, the air transport side jets. And what it is those night vision goggles were essentially light amplifiers, so they would take the ambient light and amplify it. So the other thing you could do is to look at different wavelengths of light, to look at the infrared, for example, look at heat coming off the ground. So what manufacturers have done is to mount a little camera in the front of the nose of the aircraft and align it to point straight down, and this camera was just a special infrared camera that would look at heat, ambient heat, and as you were coming to an airport and you were descending through the clouds, you would turn on the camera, and it would detect all the heat of the runway, the heat of the runway lights, and so on, and then show it to the pilot, usually on either a front display, or in fact one of the newer sort of displays, which is something that came in from the military, was an idea of a heads up system, and this was a piece of glass for military jets that was mounted front of the pilot, and you would project information about targets and speed and so on. So the commercial world said, that's a good idea. So instead of projecting all that, why not project your basic flight information there? And then when we had this infrared camera, why not project that information also on that little piece of glass that's set in front of the pilot, so they would keep their eyes outside all the time, and be aware of once they break up from the clouds, they can easily, instead of looking down and then looking back up again, to acquire where the runway was.
Well, I'm glad to hear that is getting into the more just commercial planes.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, it helps make flying safer. So anything we can do to help pilots complete their task in ferrying people back and forth safer, that's one thing that we people in our industry like to do.
Yeah,
yeah.
I'm a fan. I'm a fan of that.
Yep. Yeah, well, safer is good.
Any other interesting safety features?
Well, one of the other things that we've put in is the idea of we've looked at video games. Everybody's seen video games. You've seen games such as Call of Duty and so on, where you see all this, or World of Warcraft, where you have this strange mountains and so on being generated in the background, or even movies and so on. You can generate mountains. So we thought, the industry said, why not be able to do that where instead of rendering some fictitious terrain, we rendered the actual world on the display and show the pilots where all the mountains and hazards are. And that was pretty powerful. Previously, you had this blue over brown background on your attitude indicator. Now we render this synthetic vision system, which draws all these terrain, the mountains and water features and airports and
really,
so on.
They're the real bodies of water and real.
Yeah,
real terrain. Wow,
real terrain.
Just on a Cessna or whatever, you'd have something like that.
You could get that if you had, some of the smaller aircraft. You could actually put that in.
Wow.
Even home builds can get that too.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
What about running into other planes?
That one.
I'm not good at paying attention. I need some helping.
Yeah. So there's traffic collision avoidance system. You might hear it referred to as, and the aviation industry is full of abbreviations. So you might hear it referred to as TCAS, traffic collision avoidance system. And what it does is you have this little piece of equipment on board your aircraft, which essentially sends a ping out. And listens for responses, and based on repeated pings and responses, is able to figure out where all the other aircraft are in the vicinity of your aircraft, and then it essentially queries each aircraft and says, okay, based on signal returns, you can calculate based on the speed of light how far that particular aircraft is. Each aircraft responds with
the ping is in the optical spectrum.
No, it's actually in the RF spectrum.
Okay, radio frequency. that's still at the speed of light.
Yeah.
Oh,
radio frequency.
Forgive me for that.
That's okay.
I have an alternative theory on how TCAS could work. Mm. I had a cat once that had this innate ability to be wherever you were next to put your foot, she would be in the way. So I figured if we could reverse engineer that. We'd have the ultimate TCAS.
Yes, there you go. This is true. This is true. In fact, there was one school of thought and about the duck and cat school of instrument flying. But you'll have to search for that online because it'll take a while to explain the duck and cat. And I'll probably find a link to that and put it on the wiki just for grins. It's very
nice.
Humorous.
So with this TCAS system, it's sending out, it radio frequency. So it basically sends a ping out that's spherical, right? And if it hits something, it'll bounce back and it's got a detector?
Yeah, it not only does when you send a ping out, the aircraft will actually, the target aircraft will actually receive the ping and respond with
it's actually sending a message back. It's not bouncing back. It's actually going,
it
oh, I heard you, I'm
packet.
Right here.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
sends
okay.
a data packet back to you that says, I'm at this altitude, and that's here's my identification. So there's some kind of ID for each aircraft. And that comes back to the sending aircraft, and it figures out based on several pings, that one over there is based on the delay time, it's so far away, it's coming closer, and based on its trajectory, I know it's going to come into my flight path in the next X seconds. Let's alert the pilots. They need to climb. And then this system is mutual. So not only will it tell your aircraft, your system will tell your aircraft to climb, the system on the other aircraft will tell it to descend.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
This reminds me, I'm a morbid sort of a chap, and I love watching Air Crash Investigation. I tell myself it so I know what to do if I'm ever in these situations, but there was one particular one where TCAS was involved, and what happened was the system warned, I think, one of the planes, it wasn't warning the pilots for some reason, which is a problem, obviously, but you'd imagine so long as at least one plane was given evasive action instructions, it would be okay. But the controllers on the ground basically gave them the opposite instructions, and the pilots didn't know which one to do, what the equipment was saying or what they were being told to do. So that brings up the question, is there a some kind of balance between what the technology is doing and what the pilots think should be done, and indeed what the people on the ground are controlling them and telling them to do?
It's usually at that situation where pilots have to take the, you know, pilots are the final authority on the safety of flight, so they will have to decide as to what needs to action needs to be taken. They have to weigh all the options and you know make the judgment call as to what evasive action to take.
So does that mean the pilots have to develop some level of trust in all this new stuff?
Pretty much so. That's one of the things that get ingrained when they go into flight training.
But that's going to be hard. You've got to trust it. You got to believe in it, and yet you got to realize that it's wrong sometimes. It's sort of like using a calculator. If you're doing your checkbook and it says you have $1 trillion, you might want to double check that.
Sure. That's one thing that we have on board our aircraft is redundancy of equipment, so you don't have just the one piece of equipment. The cross-checking of the various sources, for example, airspeed on the aircraft, for example, come from multiple sensors on board the plane versus just the one. So the pilot takes all that information into mind and decides based on the best available information what action to take.
Hmm.
Yeah. So you do have to develop some trust and decide, okay, is the controller on the ground telling me to do something which is
illogical.
Not logical. Yeah.
So what else you got on the aircraft?
Well, apart from the cabin entertainment systems, one of the most recently announced innovative things that came out was something called ADS-B. ADS-B it's a system whereby all aircraft broadcast their GPS location, that's latitude, longitude, altitude, ground speed, trajectory, to anybody around that would listen. So that tells each aircraft where everybody else is at and what they're doing based on GPS equipment on board the aircraft. This was actually used, trialed out by the FAA out in Alaska. As you know, in Alaska, control towers are few and far between. And yet pilots want to know where all the other aircraft in their vicinity are. So this was actually initially trialed in Alaska.
Sounds a lot like the same information that's coming into TCAS, though.
Pretty much, except that it's broadcast, which ADS-B stands for Automatic Dependent Surveillance Broadcast. So it's a surveillance technology, helps you be aware of your surroundings. But each aircraft will be transmitting their information, and there's a lot more. TCAS only gives you the data packet sent back gives you altitude and identification for the aircraft. With ADS-B, more information comes back, latitude, longitude, and so on.
Okay.
Yeah.
What about once you're on the ground?
Ah, that's even more exciting. Nothing is more entertaining to a pilot when they, especially in a small Cessna, is when they land at an airport at night and all they see is this large sea of blue lights. That's all the taxiway lights, and you go, wait a minute, you know.
I'm here, but where do I go?
Sometimes it's, where am I? So you take out your map, your paper map, you got your little torch, your flashlight, you're looking on your map and saying, okay, where am I? And where did the tower want me to go? And, you've seen technology with respect to GPSs being used for things like road navigation. Now, wouldn't it be nice if we had the same sort of thing on the flight deck? So when the plane lands and the pilots, instead of looking up a map and feverishly finding out where they were, would be to look at your display and it draws a road map of where you are and where the next turns are and so on. So we've had airport diagrams for a long, long time because this is part of the charting that a lot of the charting companies do. They draw up charts for airports And the next step would take these charts and say, all right, you know, we know that the top left-hand corner is latitude this, longitude that, and the bottom corner is, you know, latitude something else, longitude the other. And if we know how to translate the XY location on the chart, which we have electronic form, into latitude and longitude, if we get the location of the aircraft and we can convert that to a point on the chart, this is called georeferencing. Then we can say, all right, there you are on the chart. You look at your display, and it would have a picture of the chart for the airport, and it would show you a marker saying you are here. And you could add value to that by putting on not only you are here, but you happen to be on taxiway Delta, and the terminal that you have to go to, gate E5 is the other way, and then you could actually look at the taxi path that you would have to take.
Can you get Homer Simpson or Darth Vader voice telling you to turn left now?
You could do that. You could do that too. That would be nice.
I always wanted a sarcastic GPS, one that would go, fine, you didn't take the turn I told you. Okay, no, I'm not telling you.
I'll keep quiet now and see what happens.
That might actually be called the spouse version. But
Well, there you go. The pouty GPS. Yes, quite.
Right.
Yeah, but that's one of those things that that pilots really, really like. When they arrive, especially for business pilots, where they fly to different airports at different occasions, familiarity with the taxiways and so on is something that gets alleviated by having all these taxi charts electronically available on the flight deck.
Cool, that's cool.
Yeah.
Now, are you using? Do you use an iPad or an iPhone or anything like that when you're flying?
Yeah, for me, I use my iPhone for one thing. We have a paper checklist on the plane, and it's laminated. It's really nice. But every time we make revisions to it, even though it's few and far between, it's kind of hard to go back down and get it relaminated. So what I did was to create a PDF file, and using Goodreader, which turns out is everybody else's favorite PDF reader on the
right.
iPhone. Yep, I'm able to put my checklist for my little plane on the phone. So running through the checklist and updating it, not a problem at all.
Oh,
and,
cool.
And besides that, there's an application by a company called 4Flight, and I've got the link in the show notes. And what they've done is built an integrated system around what a pilot does. First off, they check the weather, so they have a part of the system do a weather data feed for you, so you can look at where all the weather systems are, check weather conditions at your destination, forecast, and so on. And then once you're ready to get going, you can input a sequence of waypoints that you'll be flying as part of your flight plan. And as you fly and come into an airport for landing, they've even put in electronic versions of instrument approach charts. These are the charts that pilots use, and they used to carry that in their big black bags. You know, if you were wondering what they carry in their big black bags, most of the time it's their lunch and a pile of books. And in these books, these binders have paper charts of all these instrument approaches. Now, these are available PDF by the FAA, and I believe by many international regulatory agencies that do charting. So instead of having a pile of paper, which incidentally gets updated every 28 days, I keep telling people a whole forest vanishes somewhere.
Yeah.
That's not good. Yeah. So with electronic charts, that really helps pilots minimize their carry-on weight, basically. So 4Flight is a company that does this. Jepson is another company that provides electronic charts, and you can.
That seems like a natural for the iPad.
Yes.
Oh my gosh! Fact, I just checked, and 4Flight is actually free.
Yeah, but it's a subscription.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
if you want last year's maps, you're fine. But if you want to keep updates,
something like that. Actually, they'll do a trial of the service for about a month, and then beyond that, it's I forget how much it is a year. But
they're going to have to start paying 30% into Apple, I guess, huh?
Probably. I don't know what their business model is there. But that's one thing which we use on board the flight. It's the electronic versions of the charts and so on. And nice thing about having it... Sorry, go ahead.
Kirsten, that content would still come from the official sources?
Correct, yes. In fact, the FAA in this country provides... if you go to the FAA's website, you can actually download all these PDF files.
Right.
Yeah. They just make a convenience source to be able to get at those charts. Jepson produces their own, and there are several other companies throughout the world that produce their own charts. So the nice thing about... We actually have an iPad 3G, and people ask me, why do you have an iPad 3G? You don't use 3G. Well, actually, we don't, but we use the compass and the GPS, which are only available on the 3G anyway.
Oh, good point, good point. Right. Yeah, you're not getting probably a good 3G signal when you're up in the sky.
Actually, in case of emergencies, the captain when I fly with my partner, she has authorized me to use... in case of emergencies, we are allowed to deploy 3G. to turn on the 3G in the iPhone and find out where we are, or call for help or something.
Wow, this is pretty cool.
Yeah, I'll get weather. And with the GPS and the iPad 3G, we can actually have that little plane on the chart move along, and you can almost follow the bouncing ball.
Or you hope it's not bouncing, right?
No, that would be bad turbulence day.
All right, so you mentioned that when you see a pilot go in, they've got this giant bag, but it's full of books. How do you carry now? What do you have with you?
Well, there's this device called an electronic flight bag. A lot of large airlines and several business jet operators actually provide their pilots with previously with e-ink devices. Think Sony e-reader or something like the Amazon Kindle.
Uh-huh.
There was a device once made by a company I can't remember its name now, but it was an e-ink device that lets you put charts on it. And I think Jepson was one of the companies that actually provided charts for that. So you would download, much like the iPad, download all your charts to this one device. And this predated the iPad anyway by quite a while.
Oh, okay.
And pilots would be able to refer to their technical documents, all the aircraft manuals and policies and so on would be on this device.
Oh, so this is something you would carry instead of carrying an iPad?
Yep. Yeah, this predated iPads, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
That was probably pretty cool for about 15 minutes till the iPad showed up, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it's color versus black and white. But the nice thing about e-ink is this. E-ink's devices can actually keep the image without any power.
Oh, right. In a plane, that's pretty important, right?
Mm-hmm. So that was the only plus point with those devices. So there are several levels of integration. You could have a standalone EFB, electronic flight bag, or you can plug it in to get power from the aircraft or get position from the aircraft. So three different levels. And so that's what pilots use. And in fact, one of the on a different tangent, when we talk about control of flight, has anybody seen this really cool thing you can control with your iPad? It's called the AR Drone Parrot. It's got four little propellers. It's like a little helicopter that takes off, and you tilt the iPad. It flies around.
Yeah, I got to play with one of those.
Oh.
They don't fly for very long, though.
No, but the nice thing is that it is able to hover by itself. Now, hovering by itself is a really deep and
difficult.
It's a difficult control system. So it has, and I checked on their website, it's got gyroscopes and accelerometers and so on board the little parrot. And it can tell if it's tipping off to one side and is able to compensate for that. So similar things are being used of course, you know, being looked at to control the aircraft for self-autonomous flight, for example, but it's all in the research stages.
But
right
not
now.
Not to be done for hovering, right?
No, I've not seen hovering yet, no.
I did read somewhere of a test where they were trying to get a helicopter that you could stick it in hover mode and it would.
Okay,
oh, yeah.
Which one of you guys wants to fly a Harrier AV-8 and trust that we know how to do hovering yet? What is it? The Royal Air Force. That's the plane. Yeah, that's a plane that they. It's like if you really, really are manly, you're going to fly that one because you know you've got like a 30% chance of sudden death. Right.
I've read some very interesting stories about flying Harriers.
Yeah. Did they all end in sudden death?
A lot of them ended up with helmets cracking the windscreen.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. No. That's,
but it's one. It's one of the most interesting aircraft that can actually fly backwards.
You know, we were driving down to San Diego one time. We were driving past Camp Pendleton, and my son was very, very young, but he was always really observant. And he just said, "Hey, Mom, how come that helicopter or that airplane isn't moving?" And I realized it was a Harrier, and it was right next to the freeway. It was just sitting there in the air. It was the creepiest thing. It was awesome.
Yes, there you have it. So it's in its infancy, autonomous flight. Lots of research is going on, and
why don't we get those self-driving cars working first?
Would that be nice? I'd be first in line for one, but I do want a steering wheel just in case.
No, I would abdicate immediately. I think almost any computer is probably a better driver than I am. So,
oh, there you go.
All right. Well, hey, this was really, really fun. I enjoyed it. I had no idea things had gone quite as far from mechanical to electronic in such a short period of time. Well, thank you both for coming to this. I really enjoyed this. And Alistair, I like having you as backup here. And for those listening, we had hoped to talk about photography as well of aircraft, but it looks like we've got one in the pocket for a future chit-chat across the pond now.
Right. Thank you, Alison. Thank you, Alistair.
Goodbye, Kishan.
All right. Thank you a lot. Alistair. Appreciate
Thanks,
you
everybody.
Coming. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, bye.
Well, that was a lot of fun. I still can't believe we pulled off a chit-chat across the planet from literally across the whole planet. That was really, really cool. Well, that's going to wind us up for this week. Many thanks to our sponsors for helping to pay the bills. We've got ScreenStep, Smile, and, of course, Honda Bob. Don't forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com. Follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. If you want to join in the fun of the live show, and I highly recommend it, it's a crazy party in there right now. We're talking about monkeys and squirrels. I don't know what's going on. Salad? There was a whole argument about salad. I don't know what they're talking about, but they seem to be having a good time in there. If you'd like to join the live show, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time. If you'd like to just lurk and watch after the fact, you can always go to ustream.tv and just do a search on NoSillaCast and you'll find all of the previous recorded shows. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.